Isaiah chapter 23, as we study the last of these 11 nations that are copying it in God's judgment. Take a look, if we can, back here at these different acts of God's judgment. It's been a while, so it's time to get back to this. Act 1 was all about Judah and the misbehavior of the Jewish people. Act 2, which is what we're still in the middle of here, all of these Babylon and Assyrian woes, the wars with Moab, Damascus, all these others. And then Act 3 is coming up, and that'll be about Judah again. So Isaiah the poet, Isaiah the prophet, brilliant, and I love his poetry. You'll see it more and more. So he's run these oracles against all the nations, and every one of them, 10 Gentile nations, tonight's number 10, and the 11th is, of course, Judah, copping it hard for all their misbehaviors. He listed some of them by real name and some of them by not real name, as in Swampland, Silence, Wasteland, and the Valley of Vision, odd nicknames. But sometimes we don't want to say Obama, we'll say that fox. Oh, wait, that's been done. These are the typical oracles against the nations. The solution to the problems of Judah is the king, David's king, who's coming. The solution to the ones we're looking at is the day of the Lord and the acts of God, God getting involved himself. We'll look at that more specifically. And the king who's coming, 87 times we see in this section, Yahweh, in his tetragrammaton name, so abundant in his naming that he is clearly the answer. So, Lord, help us as we study chapter 23, that we might learn, that we might remember, and we might live in a way that pleases you in Yeshua's name. Here we are, chapter 23 of Isaiah. You got the book? You got the place? Wonderful. We're looking at Tyre tonight. Nickname Tyre, capital city of Phoenicia. The Phoenicians, not Venetians, but Phoenician. The Phoenicians were a merchant people who lived there on the Mediterranean. Basically, it's Lebanon in modern-day talk. That's what Tyre is. Verse 1, wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed without house or harbor. Harbor is really the word bow, which means coming, isn't it? It's reported to them from the land of Cyprus. So over in the island, Cyprus, in the Mediterranean, so he's sitting on the island of Cyprus, sending a note, an email, to the people over in Tarshish. That's where the ships are coming from. Where's that? Spain, right? And that Tyre, meaning Lebanon, is destroyed, without house or without harbor. That would be as devastating as saying there's no mining in Australia, as saying there's no cocaine in Afghanistan, that there is, what did we lose today? 500 points on Wall Street. So this is basically saying, I'm going to talk about Lebanon just when everything in their economy is collapsing. There's nothing that they're known for but being a merchant ship people, and now their harbor's gone, which means not only whatever was coming is not going to get there, but whatever they had is not going to go out. They are devastated. End of story. It's like a farmland with no crops and with salt being poured over it. Verse 2, be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon. Sidon is the other big city in Lebanon. Your messengers crossed the sea and were on many waters. So here's this declaration to the ships that are coming from Spain that are docked there in Kitim, in Cyprus. He's even telling mariners to cry. Ship people don't cry. They're tough. You know, they're pirates. No, they're just regular guys, but they're longshoremen. And they're not used to crying, but he's telling them that they ought to cry because there's no hope of being paid and no hope of continuing in life as they know it. Verse 3, they were on many waters. The grain of the Nile, the harvest of the river, was her revenue, and she was the merchant or market of nations. Sahar, be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks. How do you like that rhetoric? The sea speaks. In other words, not only is the declaration going to go to the shippers and the shipping industry that everything is gone, the Mediterranean is collapsing, devastation has happened. Think hurricane into Philippines or into Indonesia, and everything they know is wiped out. But now there's no hope for the merchants themselves. And if you look back at Revelation 17, we might find something interesting here. Revelation 17, we looked at it last time about fallen is Babylon the Great in chapter 18. But before that, chapter 17, come here, verse 1, I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth commit acts of immorality. Those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. Whoever this is, whom we discover in verse 5 is called Babylon, is Mediterranean-based and is called a prostitute. But look with me, just keep your finger there, we're going to come back to Revelation. Look at chapter 23 of Isaiah and verse 16. Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten prostitute. To whoever this prostitute is there in Tyre and Sidon, it's, I believe, the same one that's referenced in the book of the Revelation, chapter 17. It is the judgment that falls on those who reject God and who live like godlessness is normative. Go back to Revelation, and you'll see it not only in chapter 17, but in chapter 18. Yeah, chapter 18, verse 2 of Revelation, he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling place of demons, prison of every unclean spirit, a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations, sounds the same, have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. That word immorality is pornuo. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. So this idea of the merchants of the earth, same phrase that's used in Isaiah, of the merchants of the Mediterranean, are drunk with her. He uses the word pornuo, what we get pornography from, but really it's just sexual impropriety. Or in the Hebrew back in Isaiah, zona meaning prostitute. It's the same idea. So whoever Babylon is in Revelation, which we decided was not a city so much as people who were rejecting God, that same idea is carried here in Isaiah chapter 23. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 23 and verse number 3. You can see it at the end. She was the market, sachar, meaning also merchant of nations. So, Sidon, verse 4, be ashamed. The sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I've neither travailed nor given birth. I've neither brought you young men nor reared virgins. What does that mean? It's great rhetoric. What did they not produce? I mean, the words are clear. Children. They didn't produce children. They didn't make families of concern. They made money a concern. And their money was their children. Their money was what mattered to them. End of the day, they didn't have families. They didn't rear virgins. They didn't bring up young men. They didn't travail. They didn't give birth. They didn't keep producing things that were going to keep producing. They only made things for themselves. When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre. Pass over to Tarshish. Yivru Tarshisha. Wail, O inhabitants of the coastland. Is this your jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places? In other words, that's all you got? That's all you've got? End of the day, you had it all invested in a ship, and all your ships are down? End of your life. End of story. What a wipeout. What a waste. And there are countries and there are people who've given themselves to this kind of investment that goes nowhere, that's as deep as their own wallet, and then that gets nicked and they're empty. So it's a picture of emptiness. It's a picture of judgment. Again, like all these other judgments on all these other nations, Tyre, meaning Lebanon, is going to cop it as well. Not only is there a declaration of this, well, look at verse 7, sorry. Is this your jubilant city? Its origin is from Kadma. This idea, this phrase, Mimei Kedem, Kadmata, is the same phrase or the same idea that's used in the prophet Micah chapter 5 about the one who would be born in Bethlehem, who is Mikedem, who is from way back when. Kedem usually is used biblically of a geography term, meaning to the east, come of a Kedmah, son of an Egmah. But it's never translated that way here. It always has to do with antiquity or way back when. Why? Because the sun rises in the east. So if you say it's from the east, you're saying it's from not Iran or Iraq. You're saying it's from yesterday, before the sun rose. But it doesn't mean literally yesterday. Look, before you had calendars, that's what it's saying. Verse 8, we get an explanation of why this takes place. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth? Answer, the Lord of hosts has planned it. Adonai Tzvaot has planned, we know that from his declarations in chapter 14, with Babylon, Assyria, and Philistia. The Lord of hosts has planned, and who can prevent it or disannul it? Same phrase is used here. The Lord of hosts has planned it. It's God's plan that accomplishes these things. The Lord of hosts has planned it. Why did he plan it? It doesn't matter why he planned it, though he's going to explain it. But that he planned it gives a reader and a believer, what does it give the believer? To know that God has planned all these things for Lebanon, or for you, or for me. What does it give you? Confidence in him, which gives you
hope,
good, which gives you peace. It gives you ease. It gives you confidence and hope that he's still going to be in charge, so that I can trust him all that much more. I got a phone call and an email today. I got to tell you, I love the Lord. I just love how he does what he does, by the which he affirms his own hand in everything. Just before Christmas, I got the office here received an email from a Jewish man who lives out in WA. And I call him Alan. That's not his name, but we'll leave it there. And Alan was really frustrated with his life. He, in a couple emails, told me that he'd almost taken his life. I think he tried suicide. He didn't really say that, but he said it. He sounded like he was 30 at times. It sounded like he was 50. I couldn't really tell. He said he was married. I couldn't. There were so many things. So after a couple emails, I sorted out some things. I made a couple phone calls. Finally, on Christmas Eve, I talked to him, and it was just before we were shutting for the holiday. And I got to pray with him that he might accept the Lord. He's in his 30s. He's a medical doctor. He's married. He has a couple kids. And he found such peace in a heartbeat from heaven that it was so clear to me. I mean, what a joy. Just a great joy. All right. Now I go on leave. But one of the things I do with people when they come to faith, and you need to do this with people, when they come to faith in Yeshua, one of the things I do is the next day and the next day and the next day, for the next as long as I can, I'll read the Bible with them at the same time each day, a chapter or so from John or Matthew or something, and then end in prayer. It takes all of about 5 minutes. But oftentimes the guy will have more questions and they'll come up and we'll talk and we'll pray, and it might turn into a half hour, but no more than that. And that way it's not too much, it's not too tiring, and they, it turned out great. So he found the same Bible online that I happen to have. Mind you, I was on leave, but what do I want to do on leave? But disciple new believer, that was great. So Alan and I talked each day for the next week. In fact, when I went down to our village, I was still talking to him, and that was really great. And then I went to California, so I didn't talk to him again for the next week. I came back on Saturday, went to Hobart, came back Monday, and haven't talked to him yet. But today I'm sitting in that funeral out in Five Dock, and right on midday I get a beep on my phone, which is the time I'm supposed to call him. And I thought, I've dismissed that beep for the last week and a half, but I didn't today. Well, I didn't get up out of the funeral and call, but I felt a real burden in my heart to pray for him. And I prayed fervently just then in an unusual way. I mean, I say prayers for each of you. You're new. But I prayed for each of you and on a regular basis. And I like that. But it's more a phrase, maybe a paragraph. But this was like a whole short story I'm telling God. And I'm feeling a little weird because I'm crying during the funeral anyway. And I'm praying this like short story to God about Alan. Okay. I get out of the funeral. I drive over here. We meet up. We have a nice conversation. So we've got all these things. And I've got other work. I've got a stack of things I'm dealing with. And just around a quarter till four, I get on my computer and I look at my emails for the first time today. There's an email from Alan written 3 hours earlier when he writes this long treatise of his own devastation, how sad he is, how he wants to give it all up again. I'm reading this thinking, and he begs for faith and yada yada. Anyway, long story. I am so thrilled that God led me to pray so that he could write this email, which, by the way, he started yesterday but didn't feel led to send it until today. So anyway, I rang him immediately. And we had another half-hour conversation that was thrilling and beautiful, and he understood that you can do kitzatz, you don't have to do the whole thing, that you can. So here is God in heaven planning and orchestrating, and who can disannul it? The Lord of hosts has planned it. Who can disannul it? I look at that and I say, that gives me hope, not just for me, but for Alan in WA. It gives me hope for you and you and each of us around here and everyone listening online. It gives me hope for people, which gives me comfort, which means I can be part of God's plan. I don't have to create the silly plan. I don't have to accomplish the plan. The Lord of hosts has planned it. Who can disannul it? Isaiah 14:27. Nobody. Not even me. So there I am getting a little beep in my telephone, and God is orchestrating. He's the Lord of hosts. What does hosts mean? Adonai Tzvaot. Armies, that's right. He's the boss of all the armies. So even if things that look military, things that look dominant, things that look powerful, they're nothing to him. He can override the plans of generals and presidents and prime, they think, ministers, because he's the prime and not us. Robert Burns, the best laid plans of mice and men, gone off to glay, often go astray. But God's plans never. The old Yiddish expression is, man plans and God laughs. It's not a snarky kind of laugh that God does either. It's a kind of a grandfatherly thing. Sure, honey, you go try that. But it ain't gonna work. No, really, I'm gonna bowl out Chris Gayle on my first pitch. Yeah, good luck with that. I'm gonna play third base for the New York Yankees. No, really, fine, honey, you go try that. The Lord of hosts, verse 9, has planned it. But in this case, he's saying what he will do. He's explaining what the declaration was in verses 1 to 7. To defile the pride of all beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth. That's what God's planned. Those who put themselves up as numero uno, he says, no, you're actually going to be number 2 or 12 or 8,000. Okay, verse 10. Overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There's no more restraint. He stretched his hand out over the sea. He's made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its strongholds. He said, you shall exult no more, O crushed virgin daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces and made it a ruin. Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed. So here he explains that it's God's plan that's going to level Tyre. Just in the same way as he wiped out already Egypt. We saw that in chapter 19. and Babylon in chapter 14, in the same way he's going to judge Lebanon or Tyre. And in the same way that Assyria, they were the bad guys through this whole episode, were destroying Babylon in like 40 years from now, 689 BC. In the same way Tyre and Sidon would be destroyed by Babylon when it comes back to power 100 years later. What's the number one sin that Tyre committed? Verse 9. Gaon. The pride. Gaon. Even though they had, see, they had all this beauty. Yeah, they had all this beauty. And they could have been thankful to the God who gave it to them. Instead, they were proud of it over against other people. That's always the problem. It's not that God gives you stuff. It's that God gives you stuff to serve people, he doesn't give you stuff to trumpet it over other people. Verse 15, Bayom Hahu, there it is, that phrase that Isaiah loves. On that day, it will be Bayom Hahu. In that day, look out, because there's something coming. Sometimes that day is a year from now. Sometimes that day is 150 years from now, when he brings what he says to pass to pass. So when Babylon is going to go down, sometimes that's 150 years later. Or Assyria, you never know when Isaiah means in that day. But look what's going to happen. Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years like the days of one king. In other words, the tenure or the rule or reign of a king. Think Queen Elizabeth. At the end of 70 years, it'll happen to Tyre as in the song of the Zona, there it is, the song of the harlot again. Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot, pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. Good luck with that. It'll come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. One more, her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. He says that Lebanon will be out of business for 70 years. They did. The Phoenicians had restricted trade from the year 700, which was just about 20 years after this, to the year 630 BC. 70 years. So Isaiah's prophecy comes to fulfillment. People who say, oh, the Bible is just a bunch of balderdash. A lot of mythology. Well, I don't know. Sometimes there are prophecies like this one that was literally true. You could look at it. You could know Isaiah's writing this down 20, 30 years earlier, depending on when people say this was. But it definitely was before 700. He says, you've got 70 years, Tyre, Sidon, you're going to be bankrupt. You can't imagine that. Since Lebanon, the Phoenicians were prominent tradespeople. You can't imagine. It'd be like saying that, just think of Venezuela and the oil that comes from there, or OPEC, the oil-producing countries, and say, you guys are going to be dry, out of business for 70 years.
Yay. People say,
but you say, that can't be, because they are full on, and they've got plenty of economic stability. When Assyria began to weaken in power, Tyre and Sidon revived their business. So at 630 BC, after Phoenicia's been out of business, Assyria starts to wane. We already saw that earlier predicted in Isaiah. And because of that, then Sidon gets a revival. Sometimes when an oppressor is oppressed, those whom they oppressed are now lifted higher. That's just how the game of war works. So Isaiah compares the revived city of Tyre to an old hooker when she had to sing songs to get attention. Which makes sense when you think of shipping industry. But it basically says the shipping industry won't be as lucrative as it used to be. That's really what it is. Verse 18, Isaiah is looking ahead to those who dwell, look at that, in the presence of the Lord. What's that? But the kingdom of God when Yeshua comes. Yeah. One of those kings that he keeps giving us throughout his prophecy. sometimes very clear in chapter 7, sometimes in chapter 9, very clear chapter 11. We're going to see it a lot more in the second section of Isaiah from chapter 40, 42, 50, 53, especially 63. We're going to see lots more about the Messiah and the Messianic kingdom. But here's a hint of it that says in verse 18 that this old hooker and her wages will be set apart to the Lord. That doesn't mean they're giving. Hookers are not giving a tithe at church. It doesn't mean that. It just means that what their money is collected for is going to be abandoned by them, and God's going to get full use of that, which is pretty cool. Her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire. It's great for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. We've been looking over these last 10, 11 chapters at 11 nations, and they've taught us some lessons. Let me run those lessons by us, and let's talk about those and see how they mean, what they mean to you. Number one, that God is boss. He's in control of all the nations of the world, those who love him and those who don't love him, those who should love him and are less than that, and those who don't even know about God. Somehow, even that, God is in control, and he will do whatever he wants to do. You said the word sovereignty earlier, and that is pretty impressive. Wasn't there a coin called a sovereign? But think about it. What's sovereign mean? What was on the picture? What was the picture on the sovereign? Probably the queen. Maybe on the backside would have been a crown, something like that. Because crowns are kings, and kings are rulers, and nobody can dominate over them. We say your lordship, lordship. What's the Latin word for Lord? Dominus. That's right. Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. And dominate comes from Lord, and a Lord should dominate. But Adonai Melech, Adonai Malach, Adonai Yimloch Le'olamvoed, the Lord is king. The Lord rules. He was king, and he will be king forever. So this idea of lordship, though individuals think they are, he's the king of all those who do think so. He is the king of kings and lord of those who dominate, who think they dominate, but they don't. So whether it's somebody in political power, military power, we've seen those in the past few weeks, or in economic power, as in Lebanon tonight, no, you're not the boss. That's number one. We've seen that in all of these episodes. Number two, God especially hates the sin of pride. Out of all the sins in the world, and they are, oh, I don't know, a few. Just, really, stealing a pencil is pride? What if you needed a pencil? And the guy next to you has like seven pens in their pocket protector. They're an engineer. And they've got seven pens and three pencils sitting there. And you just want one. You just want one. What's wrong with stealing just one? You're not even stealing. You're just borrowing it forever. You're just taking it. What's wrong with that? Good. So you become Lord of stuff. And as the Lord of stuff, you can move things hither and thither, right? You can move things where you want. And you say, I deserve that. And you can back up and say, pride says, I don't need God to tell me whether that's his pencil or my pencil. Thanks. It's mine. And I'll thank myself for gaining it since God didn't provide that for me. But pride disallows God's provision of himself and all he can satisfy. He hates the sin of pride because, as you say, everything comes from pride. Rebellion comes from pride. People used to say pride and rebellion were the two major first sins of Hanachash back in the garden. But rebellion itself comes from pride that says, and we saw it in Isaiah, I will lift up my throne above the throne of God. I will be like God. I will. So it was the volition of the serpent, of Lucifer later. I'm sorry, Lucifer first, the serpent later. And the sin that you and I commit, more often than anything else, I will do whatever the heck I want to do. I don't care what God says. I will. And really, it's a choice. That's what will is. Will is the choice before the verbalized choice. Will is where the real action is in your heart. They say there are five senses, seeing, smelling, you with me, bodily senses. That would be described in Bible as the flesh, or sorry, the body. The soul is understood to be intellect, emotions, and will. Some people major on being intellectual. Some people on emotion. Both of those are merely soulish. The will allows us to choose in which direction we go. But deeper than both of those, body and soul, is the spirit realm. That's where we find intuition, revelation, and conscience. And when we live in the spirit realm, we are way ahead of the game. But the only way to get there is by will. By will. I will not be like God. I will not raise my throne above the throne of God. I will submit to his plans. Third, God judges the nations, each of these, for the way they treat each other. The way they treat each other is how God judges them. So when the Assyrians beat up the Babylonians, or the Babylonians later come in and beat up the Assyrians, when both of them alike, remember we had the northern kingdom, of Israel aligning itself with Assyria to try to beat up on those guys, or Moab was involved. All of these were designed to remind us of one thing. God judges the nations for the way they treat each other. You say, but wait a minute, that's not exactly fair. That's his exclamation mark. Wow. You say, that's not exactly fair, because the law was only given to the Jewish people. So the Jews should be judged for how they treat other people, but how are the Assyrians or the Moabites or the Syrians or the Egyptians or the Lebanese, how do they know? They don't know. Why is that fair? Romans 1 and Romans 2. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20 was the one you referenced. And chapter 2 and verse 12 is the one I'm going to mention. 1:20 of Romans. Who's they?
Everybody.
All nations. Everybody. So what's he saying here? Since the creation of the world, they're without excuse. Why? Because God has made known everything about himself through what was created, through what has been clearly seen, and what has been made. So when you stand down there at Bondi Beach and look out, you can see order and you can see disorder. You can see judgment, you can see righteousness, you can see peace, and you can see disturbance. You can see the whole lot right there. You can see that man, who takes forever to build a 20-story building next door, can only build one little building, and it takes forever and a lot of equipment and a lot of noise over there. But down there, God spoke and the world was. And it's massive, and it's what we call global. Yeah, nobody has an excuse. That's why people are to be judged. You read Romans 1 in context, it's pretty awesome. Look at chapter 2 and verse 12 of Romans. Or don't. For all who have sinned, all Israelis who have sinned, I caught him. All who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. So the Gentiles who don't have Torah will be judged without Torah. But they will be judged, and all the Jewish people who have Torah will be judged by Torah. So all of these 10 nations here will be judged without Torah, but by the same judge of all. And Judah, who kept messing up and will keep messing up, is going to be judged by Torah. All of that to say, everybody's going to be judged. Number 4, God always has a word of promise. That's why we call this book Isaiah. It's not only his name, but it's the book of salvation. It is God's hope. Our hope is that we will be saved. Look, Babylon's going to fall, but God is going to care for Judah. That's what we saw in chapter 14. Moab will not accept sanctuary from Jerusalem, but God will one day establish the Messiah's throne there. Chapter 16. We saw earlier that Assyria and Egypt will both be avowed enemies of the Judeans, but one day, chapter 19, all three are going to be worshiping together. So what does that say? That says that there's hope, real hope, based not on the United Nations saying, I tell you what, all you guys, we'll all get along and we'll sing Kumbaya down by the bonfire. The real hope of humanity is God himself. And it's even the hope of that prostitute whose wages are going to be offered. So no matter how bad we see ISIS gaining ascendancy, or no matter how bad the economic downturn will take our super right out of our wallet, God is in control. He's sovereign, and he knows what we need. Psalm 2, just one last verse here. Amaragushugoyim. Why do the nations rage? About the songs, the Chichester Psalms written by Leonard Bernstein. Some of the most beautiful and powerful music. Ura Hanevel, it started. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising or imagining a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Say, come on, let's tear their fetters apart from us and cast their cords from us. So what does God do? Verse 4. Yeah, there you go. I mean, this is, you go ahead and make up your rules and make up your games and make up your sovereigns and hand them out with your picture on the front. And God laughs. And he scoffs. And he'll speak to them in their anger. But God says in verse 6, but I've installed my king, Al Tzion Har Kodshi, on Zion, the mountain of my holiness, on my holy mountain. So God's hope, the hope for all people, is not the United Nations, but the nations united under God. That is our hope. As a result, what do we have to fear? Nothing. Nothing to fear because God is, well, he's consistent with his name. He's boss. And if he's the boss, move over Bruce Springsteen. If he's the boss, there is a God. He knows where we are. He's found Bondi. He can find Madagascar. He can find Syria and Iraq. He can find the Syrian refugees. He can find our people. He can find Israelis. And he can bring them to himself.
Yes.
Look, I think God knows how to chase Alan out in WA and to chase you and to chase me.
Yes.
And he does it with aplomb and he does it with gentleness. He's the Lord of hosts. Who can disannul it? Nobody. I have great confidence in him. And in my life, messy sometimes as it is, because he's boss. If you know him, then that comfort is yours as well. Lord, thanks for this chance to be in your word and the encouragement that this story of the Phoenicians bring us. Really, it's the story of God over the peoples of the world. We trust you. Thank you for Ken Duncan. Thank you for his testimony and faithfulness. Bless him tonight. Thank you for Nicholas from Russia, for Alan in WA, and for each of us around these tables, that we might continue to reflect and consider your great love. You are an awesome God who reaches and touches us when we don't even know it. We are ever grateful. In Yeshua's name.